This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today to the Afternoon Magazine. America's 19th century industrial revolution was powered by the horse. On the program this afternoon, how the horse fueled the United States' rise to industrial powerhouse. Our guest is Ann Norton Green. She's the author of Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America. Green points out in her book that as America moved toward mechanization, the need for horsepower grew dramatically for most of the 19th century. Horses, she says, were prime movers. They were an essential source of power. Horses aided transportation, construction, manufacturing, agriculture. During the Civil War, thousands of horses were needed for hauling wagons and weapons. Green writes, without understanding the impact of horses on the social and material environment of the 19th century, it is impossible to understand the industrial transformation of American society. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455-800-222-WILL. Ann Norton Green is a lecturer and administrator in history and sociology of science at the University of Pennsylvania. Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ann Norton Green, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You open the book with the story of an influenza epidemic in the 1870s that affected horses, and as a result, it seems people realized that they had taken the horse a bit for granted. Would you give us some sense of how the horse was central to daily life and city and country life as in the 19th century?
Well, if you were an urban resident in the 19th century, probably every single thing that you used or consumed had come to you via horsepower in some way or another. That almost every product between production and consumption is being either both produced and transported by horsepower at some point on that journey as a product. It was a fact of life so ubiquitous as to probably not even be commented on very much by people, somewhat the way that we use electricity today, that we don't realize quite how much of our house is dependent on electricity until a lightning storm has taken it out.
Until the lights go out. How was the country affected then by the outbreak of horse influenza?
Well, it happened regionally. The flu epidemic, the Great Epizootic, as it's called, began in Toronto, moved to Buffalo. It was at one point called the Canadian disease. They accused Canadians of having sent it to the United States. But it was transmitted like any influenza epidemic from horse to horse. And because dense horse populations gathered in the cities and also along transportation routes, it spreads from upstate New York along the railroad lines and along the path of the Erie Canal, and moves across into central New York and strikes New York City. It moves into New England, strikes Boston. It moves down, you know, down the coast. It hits Philadelphia. It hits Baltimore. It hits Washington, D.C., and then at the same time begins to move west. So it hits Pittsburgh and then Cleveland and then Chicago. It was most intense in the fall of 1872, and by the turn of the year, early spring 1873, it's being reported at army posts in the west, and by April, approximately, it's being reported in San Francisco and Sacramento. By the time it gets to the west, like any the course of any epidemic, it is much less virulent than it had been. And so it really strikes with its full virulence in the Northeast. And when it does, it brings every city to a dead halt for a period of days. First there would be a decline in wagon traffic, and then it would start hitting the streetcars, which were all horse-drawn, and the omnibuses, or the sort of urban stagecoaches that also provided transportation around cities. And pretty soon the flow of goods from the countryside into the city or from the railroad depots, and if it was a port city, the goods would be piling up there and were not moving to factories. Things were not moving from factories, and of course the immediate effect was felt in the distribution and delivery of food, especially dairy products, ice, etc.
Yeah. So how long did this paralysis last?
Well, from beginning to end in cities, it was up to 2 to 3 weeks, although usually the period where everything really had frozen up and where the streets would be empty of any kind of animal traffic would last from, say, about 2 to 5 days, 5 days probably at the most, when nothing was happening. If you remember that cities are jammed with horse-drawn traffic, the streets are jammed with pedestrians, wagons, carts, as well as streetcars, as well as a lot of foot traffic, as well as sometimes, you know, herds of livestock being brought into market, and that what the newspaper accounts describe is the effect of a ghost town, of that animal traffic being gone. And because the animal traffic was gone, a lot of course, human traffic was gone as well. People couldn't get to work, or stores would be closed, or so there's still people around, but life is really slowed down or stopped for a few days.
Yeah, I imagine it would have felt surrealistic, although that was a term that wasn't around then. But
well, reporters sent out by their papers to describe it described a ghost town. At times, it struck them so strongly, the difference between life during the episodic and life the rest of the time.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Ann Norton Green, author of Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Belgium, in Vermilion County. Good afternoon. Line 4.
Good morning, ma'am. Good morning. Good afternoon, I guess I should say.
Yeah, good afternoon.
I was wondering, in this discussion, are we going to discuss the dilemma of present-day horse ownership? And why I say that is horse ownership today is a serious problem. And I don't want to interject this into the conversation if you don't wish to talk about it. But if you do, there are some points that need to be made.
Okay.
Well, I would say my book ends in the early 20th century.
I see.
So my concern as a historian was with describing this 19th century world, this 19th century society, which is very much a society composed of humans and animals living and working together. Under very different conditions than at the beginning of the 21st century.
Yes.
And so there's the 20th century sees a significant change in the environment and the nature of animal-human relations.
Exactly, and that's what I'm getting at. Today, at that time, a horse was was a draft animal. It was an animal that was used in commerce. It was also, I use this term lightly, a pet. Today, it is considered a pet, and we treat it in a way that should not be treated. And now people are leaving horses in state parks, tied up to posts. I have a neighbor who is, because of her financial situation, is literally starving four horses to death.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to watch it.
Well, it's the value of horses is different now. Again, in the 19th century, horses are primarily workers as opposed to pets.
Yeah.
So it's a very different situation than today.
Yeah.
And certainly than in the current economic climate. Again, it's not really a topic that comes under the purview of this particular work of mine.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, to reflect on horses in our culture then and now, because you do mention Barbaro at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. You refer to the horse as a living machine. In this period of time in the 19th century, was the horse seen as a living machine by the people of the 19th century?
Well, machine is one of the dominant metaphors of the 19th century. Just as we use a great deal of computer terminology today to describe all kinds of things, including our relationships or organizational systems. We used interface or desktop, we talk about hardware and software and outside, just for things outside the computer realm. People used the word machine in the 19th century. They were fascinated by machines. They were sort of deliriously intoxicated with the idea of powerful machinery. And they see the machine metaphor as a way to try to explain how things work. And so one of the ways that they bring horses into their realm of understanding is to describe them in mechanical terms. And, of course, horses are energy converters, and so they are machine-like in that respect. They convert the stored solar energy in plant matter, and they convert it into mechanical energy that we can then use, and so they are machines in that sense, the way that steam engines were energy converters or windmills or water wheels.
Hmm. Also, as you note, this is interesting. The people gave new machinery animal names. The iron horse, in part to express, a growing sense of mastery over nature. Do you want to expand on that for us?
Well, of course, animals are what they know. If we think back to the, energy landscape of the United States until the middle of the 19th century, the most powerful things they know are animals, and that's then how they seek to explain what these new machines do. Not necessarily how they function, but what they do. And so what does the iron horse do? It does what horses do. It gallops over long distances, hauling things, but it is faster. It is more powerful than the horse. So they are expressing the way that they can make artifacts. They can create things which replicate nature and yet harness the powers of nature to an extent that had never been seen before. And this does give them a tremendous sense of mastery. They are extraordinarily confident and optimistic people in their sense that they can improve things and construct things that will overcome the physical barriers of the material environment especially in the United States, the barrier of distance.
How did people feel about their horses?
They feel everything. They range from extremely functional approaches, that this is a source of power, this is a something that works for them, but they may not have any particular, you know, affection for it. They may not treat it very well, just the way workers are dismissed or ill-treated. So you have that extreme, all the way to people who feel a deep sense of friendship, of collegiality, of a deep bond with their horses. You find comments from people and examples of behavior across that entire spectrum.
And returning to the influenza epidemic of the 1870s, if we might, did that lead people to reflect on the treatment of domestic animals, in particular the horse?
In terms of humane treatment. It happens at a time when you have a nascent humane movement developing. Henry Berg founds the ASPCA in New York in 1867, and he's quite active in New York during the influenza epidemic with confronting drivers when he thinks the horse is sick and shouldn't be out working, and urging them to take the horse back to the stable. I would say there is the beginnings of a shift in how people view animals, a growing humane movement. There is also the context not only of this horse epidemic, but there are livestock epidemics sweeping the domestic farm animal population. And so in the period between the Civil War and the end of the century, you see the development of American veterinary medicine. You see at the University of Pennsylvania, the vet school is founded in 1884. And in between the late 1870s and the early 20th century, you see it many, many veterinary schools founded, usually in cities, to serve the urban horse populations. The USDA, the Department of Agriculture, establishes the Bureau of Animal Industry, and they sponsor a lot of research into animal diseases because the growth of the livestock industry, the concentration of large livestock populations, and the transportation of those populations via the railroad means that it becomes harder and harder to isolate animals from disease. And so there's a growing amount of scientific research into animal diseases and the ways in which those can be most minimized or prevented or cured.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Ann Norton Green, author of Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America. Let's take another call now. A listener in Clay City, line one. Hi.
Yes, I have a question about a horse is a machine. That's true. And when I go to the city, the infrastructure is such that I can pull up to a gas station and get fuel literally any place I needed to go. A horse is a more complicated animal because it eats feed.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if I'm in the city and I'm working the city, say a cart, that sort of thing, I had to go someplace to get fuel. I'm told that a horse just can't get by on grass; it has to have some type of oats or something like that to keep itself enough nutrition. What was the infrastructure like let's say at the turn of the century, I mean, you had to, I mean, a large city couldn't have piles and piles of manure everywhere. If I owned a milk route and I had a milk horse, did I have fueling stations? Did I have a barn that I had to go to on a regular basis? How long could an animal go for an entire day without eating or water? What was the infrastructure like, say, about 1900 to keep a horse in the city, say, for a period of a year? I mean, how much money would I have to spend on it? I mean, part of cost of doing business. And just kind of curious about that end of it.
Well, that's a hard question because it's difficult to compare costs over time. But in terms of the infrastructure question, let's take the horse that's pulling a milk truck part of a dairy operation delivering milk. It would start out from a stable that would be located in the city or on the city's edge, and it would work several hours delivering milk. It would most delivery people would carry a meal for the horse with them, and so you see pictures of horses, you know, tied up along the streets, harnessed to wagons, with their head in a feed bag, or sometimes they had sort of portable troughs, kind of on sawhorses, that they would keep in the back of the wagon, and put out for the horse to eat from.
Did the city have city troughs for horses?
Well, these would be feed troughs that the people using the horses would carry. In terms of water, they would sometimes carry water, but also there were public troughs for horses. And in fact, by 1900, there had been a pretty active movement in many cities to make sure that there were fountains. Many cities had fountain societies where people would build often very elaborate fountains with places for animals to drink and places for humans to drink, and this was certainly developed for humane purposes to make sure that there was water for horses. It was also, interestingly enough, developed as part of a temperance movement, hoping that the Teamsters themselves, if they had access to water, wouldn't stop at a bar for a beer and drink either. You see in hot weather, the local humane societies by 1900 are pretty active in going around in hot weather with water wagons to make sure that there's access to water. But for somebody, you know, said like a dairy with a fleet of horses and trucks, they're going to want their horses to stay in good shape. And so they are going to structure their routes and such, and so that the horses get back home and get rested. In terms of the manure, horses like automobiles or any energy converter, there's a certain amount of waste energy, and the difference between horses and cars, of course, is that it is very solid and immovable. It doesn't blow out into a big cloud and then float away. So cities had street cleaning. Some cities sold those street sweepings back out to farmers as manure, so that there was a good kind of recycling circuit going on between cities and their hinterlands with manure. Generally, though, I'd have to say that there is not a lot of creativity around developing a really good system for removing and processing that animal waste.
And that was an argument, ultimately, for those who promoted the automobile.
The automobile was seen as, yes, the green alternative to the horse again, because the first there weren't very many automobiles, and so the pollution problem doesn't seem to be significant at that point. And again, because it often it floats away or is more or less invisible, it simply didn't seem like as much of a problem, and it might blow away into somebody else's turf and become somebody else's problem as well. So it didn't have to be dealt with politically in quite the way that the more immovable horse manure had to be. But in the city streets are dirty. There's no doubt about that, that there is horse manure on the streets with other kinds of, you know, mud and dirt and garbage and all. It is definitely a problem for cities in terms of their street cleaning and sanitation.
Yeah, and there were traffic jams.
There were traffic jams. Definitely, there was no traffic control in particular. You don't get much in the way of traffic control until closer to 1920. And when you start getting electric traffic signals and more traffic police, many cities had systems of one-way streets to try to manage the traffic. But there were terrible traffic jams. And again, the automobile is touted as the solution to urban congestion.
Also, the auto is promoted as reducing accidents.
The automobile was seen as safer by people. You see a lot of rhetoric in the early 20th century about how dangerous horses are. And it's a real reminder to us that what we consider to be dangerous is relative, that as long as horses were utterly necessary, the danger question simply was ignored by people. Railroads during the 19th century are horrendously dangerous, horrible railroad accidents. The engines blow up. Trains smash into each other, they derail, they cause terrible fires, much of which is simply overlooked in the enthusiasm about railroads that people have. You know, in our own time, we know that there are things that we tolerate in the United States as facts of life, whether it's gun ownership or the amount of drunk driving that we're willing to tolerate, well before we invoke the safety thing. So, I mean, one of the topics that this study really brought home to me was the way that risk and safety, ideas about risk and safety, not only change, but often are invoked as political tactics to try to argue a case, as opposed to necessarily being argued on the basis of how much injury people are really suffering, or how dangerous to the public something might actually be.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana now. Line 2, hi.
Hello. It wasn't only horses. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
It wasn't only horses.
It wasn't only horses that were found in cities. There were also cattle.
Mm-hmm.
People kept to milk cow, and in fact, in the large cities, before they began to bring milk in from outside the city with the railroads, there were herds of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually constituted a health menace in more ways than one. They were often infected with both brucellosis and tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
So the pre-modern city was in many ways a rather different place from what we see today.
Up until the 1880s, there's a great deal of continuity between rural and urban life. because there are so many livestock animals in the cities, herds of cows, pigs, goats, chickens. It's because it takes a while for photographs to be able to capture motion. We don't often have a lot of photographs from that period of time, but the few that exist will show chickens all up and down a residential street in a city. So the cities were very organic in their nature. They are filled with animals. They are more similar to rural life. But starting in the 1870s, there's increasing distance and kind of discontinuity between urban and rural life. And one of the factors for that is that there is a concerted effort, usually led by public health departments, to kind of get livestock animals out of the cities. And by the end of the century, you see a lot of urbanites have an idea of themselves that really precludes seeing animals as part of city life. And so those urban dairies, those herds of pigs roaming the streets, the chickens, they disappear from a great deal of city life. Although, I mean, even here in Philadelphia, where I live, I know that there are neighborhoods where you can go through and hear the roosters crowing in the mornings. But there are still people keeping what we would think of as livestock in cities, but not nearly to the extent that they were through the 19th century.
I want a
story that may be apocryphal of the inspectors or the city officials in New York going up in an apartment, a tenement, I should say, and finding a cow on the third or fourth floor.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, well, how did you ever get this animal up here?
Well, the question with a cow is never, how did you get it up the stairs? It's, how are you going to get it down?
Well, of course.
The cow will climb up, but it won't walk down the stairs.
The answer was, it was brought up as a calf. You're right. Bringing it down would be much harder. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I was wondering if other species have been used as draft animals for traction, pulling wagons and plows and so on. If there's a choice, do people always choose horses over oxen, for example?
Yeah, good question.
That's a great question. What you see in the 19th century is a declining use of oxen and a growing use of horses. Oxen are much more widely used through the 18th and early 19th century than horses because, first of all, because the roads are so poor. And horse-drawn traffic over bad roads is slow and expensive. And nobody enjoys it, especially the horse. As long as you don't have a lot of market relations over wide distances, then what you're talking about is very localized economies, and in those situations, oxen made a lot more sense. Oxen are cheap; they're fairly simple to use; they're cheaper to keep than horses, because of the way that oxen eat, just different than the way horses eat. They're much less expensive to keep. They need less harness. They need less training. They are, however, very slow. And so when you start getting better roads, when you start getting more market development in the United States, then horses, which are generally more expensive to purchase, to feed, to use, and take more skill to use, then it becomes economical to use horses. The same is true in farm work, where oxen were the main source of animal power in farm work. Once you get mechanized equipment, the reaper, for example, as the reaper develops in the 1840s and 1850s, It allows you to harvest more acreage, and the value of that extra acreage, the value of the harvest from that extra acreage, covers the extra cost involved in using horses. And so the value that horses can produce in a society with mechanized equipment and with roads they generate so much extra value that then it covers the cost of using them. And so you see a decline in the use of oxen pretty steadily from the 1850s to the end of the century. By the end of the century, the census stops counting oxen at all. We know they're out there. They're being used in the South. They're being used. New England still uses a lot of oxen, and they are still used in frontier areas. But they drop out of daily life just about every place else in the second half of the 19th century.
Yeah. Same kind of question about donkeys and mules.
Mm.
And, again, where there's a choice, what do people tend to use? And,
well, when you start talking about mules, then things get really interesting, because mules are an excellent draft animal, but they're not regarded with a whole lot of respect. They're not seen as classy an animal as the horse. Horses, for most of the centuries since domestication, have been an elite animal. What makes the 19th century, in fact, rather unusual, is that it's really the only time when horses are not an elite animal, where they really are so widely used that many people have access to them. But for most of horse history, they are elite animals, and mules are always seen as a much more lowly animal, although incredibly rugged and strong and useful and smart. The problem with mules, of course, is that they're the product of they're a hybrid between a horse and a donkey, and they're sterile. So you can't breed mules from mules. You have to start from scratch every time with a horse and a donkey. So there's a bit of a production problem with mules. The donkey thing is interesting because donkeys aren't very widely used in the United States, and I don't know why. They're most widely used in the mountains of the West and the Southwest because donkeys have a different role in Spanish culture than in Anglo culture. But in Anglo culture, donkey use is not very prevalent, and you don't see many of them, except most donkeys in the United States in the 19th century seem to be used for mule breeding.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Before we take the next call, though, I do want to ask you about camels. There's a wonderful photograph in the book taken in Russia of two camels pulling a piece of equipment manufactured by International Harvester.
Mm-hmm.
The camel had some champions in the U.S. for a while, but alas, that didn't work out.
It didn't work out. There's all this enthusiasm. From about the 1830s to the 1850s, among officers who had served in the West, enthusiasm for using camels in the Trans-Mississippi region. The Army is responsible for administering vast ranges of territory, which were often hot and arid, and all their supplies have to be hauled at long distances. The Army consumes an enormous amount of the oxen power in the West to keep its forts and its posts provisioned. And so a group of officers gets this idea that if they could use camels, it would speed things up, and that camels are very strong and they're very fast. And, of course, they are adapted to desert-like conditions, and so this seemed to be, for many people, a no-brainer. They already refer to the Trans-Mississippi region as the Great American Desert, and so they think, we have a desert, we should have camels. And when Jefferson Davis becomes Secretary of the Army in the 1850s, he was one of these camel enthusiasts, and so he forms he gets Congress to pass a bill authorizing the United States Camel Corps, and they send people to the Middle East, and they buy camels, and they bring them to Texas, and they try to organize them for use in Army transport in the West. It was not a very successful experiment, however. The camels, of course, are not native animals. They're not acclimated to the United States. And they require special handling. Draft animals are not interchangeable in the sense that each requires special equipment and skills and knowledge. And the Army Teamsters for the American Army just didn't like the camels, and they weren't very good at handling them, and they were sort of offended that these, you know, dark-skinned foreigners had been brought in as camel tenders to handle the camels instead. So between the fact that they don't really fit into the work culture of the Army very well and the fact that a lot of them sicken and die, the experiment founders, and then, of course, the Civil War comes along, and the funding ends, and the camels are in Texas, and they become the property of the Confederacy, and the rest of them die or wander off.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Vermilion County, line two.
Okay, I wanted to bring up a little bit more about the mule. I just heard the part of it. See, the mule mostly is a jack and a jinny.
Mm-hmm.
That family to mate the horse. But you didn't tell us how smart the horse was. I mean, the mule, the mule, because he is so smart. If he's hot, he won't overdrink. And founder, if he's very hungry, he doesn't overeat. Mm-hmm. And founder, his feet. And that was a great thing about him. And they're very smart. Like you say, he saw his face in the pond of water and decided he was so ugly, I'll never make another one.
horses and donkeys, of course, are two different species. And what's interesting about them is that they have often have very different reactions to things. That they aren't horses are creatures of the plains, and donkeys are more kind of mountain animals. Horses tend to emphasize flight. Donkeys are a little more contentious, and so when you crossbreed them, and actually, I mean, you're right. Technically, a mule is the product of a horse mare and a donkey jack. You get an interesting combination of the characteristics of the two species. The evidence from records in the Civil War, where they were using a lot of mules for hauling wagons, and especially, does tend to show that mules aren't as smart about overeating and overdrinking as the mythology says they are. But they are the way I see it is they tend to be deeply interested in their own self-preservation, and so they're trickier to handle temperamentally. Hmm. People I know who've worked with both say that you have to think differently with mules than horses. That working with any large draft animal takes a lot of thought and a lot of skill in order to work with them successfully and humanely. And I think because people regarded mules as so indestructible, they tended to be a lot harsher on them than they would be with horses.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call. We've got to wrap up here, and I we're way out of time. and we never even talked very much at all about the Civil War. It just came up in passing, which is a really fascinating part of the book. But now we have to draw to a close. So now, lessons for us today. You wrap up your introduction by saying, you know, as we face the energy challenges of the 21st century, it might behoove us to look back to this period of time. What lessons are there for us today? And I can give you a minute.
Okay. Well, when I started working on this topic, it struck me that how often people assume that moving from animal power to fossil fuel power was logical and inevitable. And if I learned anything from this project, it's that we don't understand our energy history very well. And it's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that we assume that you can only have economic growth and industrial progress by using fossil fuels, and the reality is a lot more complicated. So I think that we have to understand that our choices about energy and our choices about technology are just that. They're choices, and they're not preordained, and that we need to understand that history a lot better as we face the energy challenges of the 21st century.
Nicely done. Ann Norton Green, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Ann Norton Green is the author of Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America. The book is published by Harvard University Press.